Today, the outlook is lower for longer. Welcome to the Property Imperative Weekly to the 15th of June, 2019. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Regional Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And of course, today this is our digest of the latest finance and property news. Today we look at the rising expectations of a recession ahead, the falling Aussie dollar, risks in the global finance system, and a few glimmers of good news, but the takeout is growth and rates will be lower for longer. Once again, I'm going to start with the international scene, and I'll put a time stamp to the local news in the comments below if you want to jump straight there. But the truth is the Australian economy is locked into global events and markets. So like it or not, what happens over there will impact us here. Being a trade-exposed open economy is not all candy. And to start, ahead of the upcoming G20 meetings, the G20 finance ministers and central bank governors meeting said this week that growth is projected to pick up, though this recovery is supported by a continuation of accommodative financial conditions and that growth remains low and risks remain tilted to the downside. Or in other words, it's thanks to low interest rates, QE and money printing. The current solution of choice, of course, despite its constant failure to perform. In the US, stocks mostly closed lower on Friday, though leaving weekly gains still intact. The Dow Jones Industrial Average shed 0.07% to finish near 26,090. The S&P 500 fell 0.2% to end around 2,887, while the Nasdaq slipped 0.5% to end around 7,797 on computer chip maker trade war concerns. For the week, the Dow was up 0.4%, the S&P 500 was up 0.5%, and the Nasdaq was up 0.7%, all at super expensive levels in my view. In fact, firmer US retail sales helped to support the market. With robust growth in May and huge up revisions to April's print, consumer spending looks to regain its footing in the second quarter, with growth expected now to be around 3% on an annualized basis. But on the downside, the slump in computer chip stocks were led by Broadcom after the chip maker missed revenue estimates and cut its guidance amid slowing demand. Facebook, however, bucked the trend, rising 2% as the social media giant's venture into cryptocurrency drew praise from the analysts. We believe this may prove to be one of the most important initiatives of the company to unlock new engagement and revenue streams, RBC analyst said in a note to investors. Energy stocks, meanwhile, also contributed to the decline in the broader market, shrugging off a rise in oil prices after recent events in the Gulf. Just on Thursday, both WTI and Brent had settled more than 2% after an attack on two oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman stoked fears of a new confrontation between Iran and the United States. But oil dropped 2% over the week. US crude stockpiles have grown by a net of some 33 million barrels over the past 12 weeks, crossing into the current peak driving season in the US, when demand for gasoline should be at the year's highs. WTI futures were up 0.46% to 52.52, still a massive 21.6% lower than a year ago. The upbeat US economic data was in sharp contrast to Chinese economic data, which showed the pace of industrial production slowed to a 17-year low as manufacturing and production sectors, many of which depend on strong exports, were hurt by the ongoing US-China trade war. With just 2 weeks to go until the G20 meeting and little sign the trade war will be resolved sooner rather than later, traders are increasingly worried that both countries will escalate tensions. And US President Donald Trump has threatened to impose levies on $300 billion worth of additional Chinese products if his counterpart fails to attend the G20 meeting in Tokyo, scheduled for June 28-29. The trade threat lever is one the president clearly enjoys using, but to what end? The yuan-US dollar slid 0.06% to 0.1444, down 7.55% over the year, and the Shanghai Composite fell 0.99% to around 2,882, down 4.6% over the past year. The US 10-year bond rate is now more than 29% down compared with a year ago, and was down 0.48% on Friday to just 2.08, and the 3-month was down 0.28% to 2.18, though still up 12.8% compared with a year ago. Thus, the yield curve inversion is still pointing to trouble ahead with expectations of lower rates as the Fed eases. And in fact, we think the US banks are entering an uncertain phase. Falling interest rates, low trading volumes, and a threat to the global economy due to the US-China trade wars are driving headwinds that could soon hurt their earnings and cloud their future. These risks are already triggering a sell-off in bank shares as investors shun stocks that are cyclical and closely tied with the health of the global economy. The KBW Nasdaq Banks Index has fallen more than 5% from this year's high, reached in early May. But that optimistic scenario is changing fast. The US Federal Reserve has clearly indicated that it doesn't want to raise interest rates this year, and its next move could indeed be down. The S&P 500 Financials was up 0.23% on Friday to 449.4, but is down 2.7% compared with a year ago. But Goldman Sachs, despite being up 0.14% on Friday to 191.7, is down 18.1% from a year back. In an industry conference this week, banking executives at some of the top lenders in the US cautioned investors about the earnings slowdown. "I'd be very surprised if we beat the first quarter," Morgan Stanley Chief Executive Officer James Gorman said at the conference. Citigroup said, on the other hand, it's expecting its second quarter fixed income and equities trading revenue to fall by a percentage in the mid-single-digit range from a year ago, while investment banking fees are expected to drop by a percentage in the mid-teens, according to its Chief Financial Officer Mark Mason. When looking at individual banking stocks, some have tumbled more than the broader market. Wells Fargo & Co. is down more than 10% in the past 6 months, while Bank of America has shed just 4% in the same period. So not all are the same. Shares of some of the largest lenders have become attractive after years of restructuring effort. Citigroup, for example, is up 19% in the period, and JP Morgan gained more than 8%. These banks are well prepared to cope with any cyclical downturn due to their sustained cost cutting during the past decade and with the rebalancing of their portfolios. Their efforts are perhaps beginning to pay off, and both have been producing strong growth in both revenue and profit over the recent quarters. But if recession does hit, then all bets are off. And on that note, Jeffrey Goodluck, Chief Executive Officer of Double Line Capital, who oversees more than $130 billion in assets under management, said that the odds of the United States sliding into a recession in the next 6 months has risen to 40 to 45%, and the odds were 65% within the next year. Goodluck said that the yield curve and the New York Fed recession probability showed a rising chance of recession. Earlier this year, a recession was not on the horizon, but the US trade wars and the weak momentum of the global economy have raised red flags for him. Goodluck said that the Fed probably would not cut rates in June, but likely would later in the summer. And he said the bond market indicates the Fed would cut rates by a quarter percentage point either two or three times by the end of the year. And as for the bond market, Goodluck, who has long forecast 6% on the 10-year Treasury yield by the next presidential election or a year after, said if the government would not get involved in the manipulation of bond yields, the 10-year bond yield would indeed rise to 6% by 2021. And of course, the current 10-year yield is about 2.1%. And he went on to say that if the United States starts heading on the path to 6%, the Fed will not let the market price and manipulate interest rates down. Overall, Goodluck said the US government has a very bad debt-to-income problem, even in a supposedly growing economy. And he says true liabilities of the US government are around $23 trillion to $24 trillion, and that if the budget deficit and the current account deficit increase, that could be a precursor for a further decline in the dollar. Unfazed, the volatility index was down 3.41% to 1528. Gold futures for August delivery was up 0.12% to 1,345, while the euro US dollar was down 0.59% to 1.1209. The US dollar index futures was up 0.56% to 97.54. In London, as the battle for the PM rolls on, a Bank of England review of 20 lenders showed that many of Britain's fast-growing, fledgling banks have little experience of downturns and could underestimate potential loan losses if markets turn sour. Britain has encouraged many new lenders to compete in a market dominated by the big four, HSBC, Barclays, RBS and Lloyds. Over the past year, the central bank has been reviewing the business models and activities of 20 fast-growing smaller lenders that have balance sheets of around £750 million. Unlike its annual tests of leading lenders such as HSBC and Barclays, the bank has not named the 20 smaller lenders placed under the microscope or any of their individual results in the study. It comes after the Bank of England's scrutiny of Metro Bank, which had to raise £325 million to repair its balance sheet after disclosing in January that it had underreported risks on its loan book. Melanie Beeman, a Bank of England director for UK Deposit Taker Supervision, said in a letter to chief executives of the 20 banks that many of them were overly optimistic about the potential impact that stressed markets would have on their business. This was most apparent in their assumptions about stressed impairment rates that could emerge and their ability to raise capital, dispose of parts of their business, or widen their margins in the context of a market-wide stress. Many of these banks have ambitious growth plans that expect the additional income from new business to offset higher impairment charges. And some of the fast-growing banks could also be in too much of a hurry, the study said. Firms are reminded to be mindful of the speed of decision-making in commercial lending cases and whether this might be compromising the quality of analysis and robustness of the underwriting process. Some of the banks relied almost entirely on funding from competitively priced short-term fixed-rate retail deposits, she added. Hi, it's Liz Interruption. But if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin, here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now, back to the current show. And Britain's financial watchdog has defended its decision not to penalise lender RBS or its former executives for past mistreatment of small business customers. The Financial Conduct Authority, the FCA, said it was sticking by its decision not to apply penalties for actions of Royal Bank of Scotland's former turnaround unit, the Global Restructuring Group, or GRG. But this is not because there was no poor behaviour, rather a technical discussion about the scope of regulation. Our investigation has found that GRG clearly fell short of the high standards its clients expected, but it was largely unregulated, and so our powers to take action in such circumstances, even where the mistreatment of customers has been identified and accepted, are very limited, the FCA Chief Executive Andrew Bailey said in a statement on Thursday. The FCA said that stronger powers had since been introduced to give it greater powers to act in future cases. RBS was down 1.07% on Friday to end at 212.4, down 18% over the past year, compared with the Financial Services Index, which is down just 2.5% over the same period. The FTSE was down 0.13% on Friday to end at 7,346, and the pound US dollar was down 0.62% to 1.2594. The euro US dollar also slid down 0.59% to 1.1209, down 4.4% over the year. and we continue to watch Deutsche Bank with interest and some horror, as it has dropped more than 36% over the past year and ended on Friday at 6.16. But perhaps things are changing. Last week, Fitch downgraded Deutsche Bank's credit rating to BBB. Fitch was the highest of the three major ratings agencies before the cut, so in this sense, it merely brings it more into line with the ratings of S&P and Moody's. Indeed, even after the cut, Fitch maintained its rating on Deutsche Bank's senior unsecured debt at one notch higher compared with either of these peers. Normally such a downgrade would be bad news, but neither Deutsche Bank's debt spreads nor share price reacted. Credit ratings matter less than they used to do for Deutsche Bank, for the simple reason that Deutsche Bank needs the debt markets less than it used to. It is taking in a lot more deposits and using these to retire wholesale debt. Total deposit balances grew by 8% between 2014 and the first quarter 2019, at the same time that wholesale debt funding, short and long-term debt as well, as trading liabilities shrank by 30%. This is good in one sense. It removes the risk of Deutsche Bank failing because of an inability to access liquidity. But it is bad in another sense, especially for equity investors, where less assets and more expensive deposits just means lower profits. This is the real reason why Deutsche Bank's share price is at an all-time low, the receding chances of the company ever returning to respectable levels of profitability. The share price remains at an all-time low. This comes down to the basic fact that what's good for debt is not always good for equity. Shrinking the balance sheet means having less interest-earning assets and therefore less revenues and profits. And deposits are also an expensive form of funding when they are being used to fund short-duration trading assets, as is the case with Deutsche Bank. This too hits profitability. And to further assuage the debt investors, Deutsche Bank is holding record high levels of liquidity that cannot be used for productive purposes in the business. The liquidity reserve currently stands at, wait for it, 268 billion euros. This explains why street estimates for Deutsche Bank are for a return on equity of 1.8% this year and 2.7% next year. Yes, it is positive that Deutsche Bank is unlikely to be forced out of business by being shut out of funding markets. This, of course, was the route by which most banks went bust in 2008-09. They ran out of liquidity, not capital. So in this sense, Deutsche Bank's problems no longer look to be quite so existential. So now let's turn to the local Australian scene. This week we had more employment data, which was pretty soft. Sure, there was a rise in part-time work, but the overall trend seems to be off the new espoused 4.5% target range the RBA is looking towards to see wages rise. And we discussed this in our post, The Good News, Bad News on Unemployment. Underemployment continues to rise as more are in fragmented forms of work, and this does not bode well for pay rises. Household confidence and business confidence both showed only limited positive news after the election result. We discussed this in our post, Post-Election Bump Reality or Mirage, where we looked at the results from the NAB business survey. Retail was pretty shocking and appears to be in recession, and our own household financial confidence surveys, which showed a weak bounce amongst property investors, perhaps a relief rally, thanks to the fact that Labour's policies were avoided in terms of tighter negative gearing and capital gains reform. We also discussed the results from the consumer sentiment surveys via Westpac and ANZ in our post, 20,000 and Counting, where we also celebrated achieving 20,000 YouTube subscribers, a big lift from a year ago, as more are understanding what is really afoot. Now, the die is cast for lower interest rates and a lower Aussie dollar, which dropped 0.58% on Friday to end at 68.73, down 8.9% from a year ago. Shane Oliver at AMP makes the point that from a very long-term perspective, the Australian dollar is around or just below fair value. This contrasts with the situation back in 2011 when it was well above long-term fair value. The best guide for this is called purchasing power parity, according to which exchange rate should balance out the price of a basket of goods and services across countries. But he says the Aussie could still face a bit more downside over the next 6 to 12 months. The main reason is that Australian growth is weaker than US growth, and spare capacity is much higher in Australia. For example, labour market underutilisation is 13.7% in Australia versus just 7.1% in the US. Growth in Australia is running at 1.8% year on year, compared with 3.2% in the US, and the drag on growth from the housing downturn is likely to keep growth relatively weak in Australia for the next year or so. This will keep inflation lower in Australia than in the US, and so he sees the RBA cutting rates more than the Fed. And the RBA is much closer to having to do quantitative easing, or some variant of it, meaning using printed money to boost growth, than the Fed. This will continue to make it relatively less attractive to park money in Australia, and in periods of low and falling interest rate differentials between Australia and the US, usually sees a low and falling Aussie dollar. But he says the iron ore price, if it remains high, may provide some support. Here, there has been some good news with the iron ore price pushing above $100 a ton, and this combined with solid growth in export volumes has pushed the trade balance into a record surplus, which has shrunk the current account deficit as a share of GDP to its lowest since the 1970s. Now, of course, the iron ore price will likely fall back sometime when Brazil's Vale gets production back to normal after its dam disaster. But Chinese economic stimulus may help keep it and other commodity prices supported. The smaller current account surplus means Australia has become less dependent on foreign capital inflows. So he concludes that with the Aussie dollar having already had a big fall, short Aussie dollar positions running high, the current account deficit having shrunk, and the US dollar looking toppy, sees the Aussie dollar falling to around 65 US cents on a 6 to 12 month horizon, as opposed to crashing down to, say, the 2001 low of 48 cents. And of course, continuing softness in the Australian dollar will be positive for Australian industry sectors that compete internationally, like tourism, higher education, manufacturing, agriculture and mining. And this will benefit shares exposed in those areas. And NAB is also calling a third cash rate cut. We think action to combat the slowdown in the economy and reduce unemployment will involve a third rate cut and fiscal stimulus, with possible consideration of other options down the track if these policies fail to have much effect. This is more than the one additional rate cut embedded in the bank's current forecast, but we think the bank's optimism has been further challenged by weaker than expected quarter one GDP, likely weak quarter two GDP, and the trend deterioration in the NAB business survey. We expect the bank will be forced to change its narrative as the year progresses, downgrading its forecast to bring them closer to our own outlook of subpar growth, rising unemployment, and persistently low inflation. Although the Reserve Bank made significant downgrades in its growth outlook in its February and May statements on monetary policy, we think that the bank's forecasts are still too optimistic. Beyond August, therefore, NAB has penciled in a third rate cut to 0.75% in November and fiscal stimulus by late this year. Alternative monetary policy options might be considered next year if these measures fail to have much effect. A third rate cut is needed to reduce the real cash rate, where expected inflation, as proxied by the 10-year break-even inflation rate, has fallen back to its multi-decade low of 1.4%. The bank may be reluctant to cut a third time, given that the governor said in 2012 that the effective lower bound for the cash rate was 1%, plus or minus a bit, although he recently cited the experience of much lower interest rates in the US, UK and Canada. Of course, rate cuts will put more downward pressure on the Aussie dollar. So how far will the RBA let it drop? Westpac is on the same hymn sheet, given that the RBA's current forecasts, which incorporate two rate cuts, were for a 5% unemployment rate this year and next, only ticking down to 4.75% by mid-2021, we expect that more than two cuts are going to be required. Today, our view holds that two more cuts will be delivered in August and November, a total of three cuts for 2019. By far the most interesting discussions is what action is likely to follow the move to 0.75% cash rate targeting. Westpac's view has been that the risks to that forecast are to the downside. Although we do anticipate a more constructive economic environment in 2020 as the housing market stabilises, fiscal policy plays a more stimulative role, and the global economy improves following two FOMC rate cuts in 2019, and the impending US election also motivating the US president to play a less disruptive role. We also speculated that if the RBA saw a continuing need to stimulate the economy, it would embrace some form of quantitative easing, or QE, rather than driving the cash rate below that 0.5 to 0.75% range, seen as the likely floor beyond which the transmission of lending rates becomes ineffective. So it seems we're likely to walk straight into the QE bear trap. Now, I think that that is bad policy. So to home prices. The CoreLogic index was higher this week after a three-day hiatus when the index was not reported. This has not been explained. Anyhow, now that they're reporting a rise this week in Sydney, up 0.13%, Melbourne up 0.19%, and Adelaide up 0.1%. Although Brisbane and Perth fell again, both were down 0.08%. That gave the five cities average a rise of 0.09% last week, although of course over the quarter all centres are down other than Adelaide, with a five city average of down 1.48%. Perth from peak is down 19.4% and Sydney down 14.9%. And yet auction clearance rates were weaker again last week, perhaps because of the Queen's birthday. As CoreLogic put it, the combined capital city final auction clearance rate came in at 48.3% last week, which is lower than the 58% the previous week. The lower clearance rate was across a lower volume of auctions over what was the Queen's birthday's long weekend, which saw 805 homes taken to auction, down on the 1,661 auctions the prior week. 1 year ago, 904 auctions took place, returning a higher 53.8% clearance rate. And UBS, always in my view on the pulse of housing and finance news, has looked at the revised household expenditure measure framework, which, as we foreshadowed a couple of weeks ago, is now being rolled out. They estimate that the RBA rate cuts and APRA's removal of its interest rate serviceability floor may improve maximum borrowing capacity by around 14%. However, these changes need to be considered in the context of ongoing tightening, a new HEM methodology, the rollout of comprehensive credit reporting, and open banking. A new estimate of the household expenditure measure, a floor on estimated living expenses in mortgage calculations, is being rolled out by the banks over coming months. Their channel checks indicate that the revised HEM is skewed to higher income earners, especially those with an income above $120,000, although each bank now applies the HEM slightly differently. They estimate that for households with incomes above $150,000 and around 33% of owner-occupied mortgages by number and 50% by value, the increase in HEM may more than offset the impact of lower interest rates and the removal of APRA's serviceability floors. Given that 50-60% of borrowers are still assessed using HEM assumptions, these changes may have a material impact on the housing market, especially in Sydney and Melbourne, given higher median incomes and house prices. Investment property buyers are also generally higher income earners and will also be impacted by these changes. For lower income households, the impact of HEM changes is less material, implying the benefit of rate cuts and the removal of serviceability floors may be more effective. And we agree in that home prices were pumped up due to ultra-low HEM calculations, interest-only lending, and downright fraud. Banks are still using HEM for around half of new loans, and so the impact on home prices of rate cuts and looser lending will be severely limited, hardly, in fact, enough to stop prices from falling ahead. Without mortgage fraud, it will not be possible for a real bounce in home prices, which is, of course, actually a good thing. Both CoreLogic and Fidelity discussed the coalition announcement of the First Home Loan Deposit Scheme. The scheme will provide up to 10,000 loans to first home buyers each year. and will offer first home buyers better access to finance without having to save a 20% deposit. The scheme will commence on the 1st of January 2020 and will be operated by the National Housing Finance and Investment Corporation. Support for borrowers could include guaranteeing approved applicants the additional loan amount taken out by the first home buyer to cover the difference between the amount of the first home buyer's deposit and 20% of the value of the property. Of course, we are light on details, although those following DFA will know that we are sceptical of this approach and the thought bubble has little detail. And CoreLogic says the scheme is positive in that it allows first home buyers to borrow a smaller deposit and without lender's mortgage insurance. The benefit of this is they can potentially own a home earlier. From a housing affordability perspective, it is difficult to see, however, how this policy actually helps. Given that borrowers still need to pass their usual credit checks, the only people that will have access to the scheme are those that could have already purchased. While the scheme may help borrowers enter the market earlier, it seems unlikely that it will do anything to improve housing affordability. If anything, they say, it might increase demand from first home buyers and lead to higher prices within the price points that fit the maximum loan sizes, which have not yet been determined. And Fidelity, as cited in the Australian Financial Review, said that introducing subsidies on the buy side doesn't address housing affordability. The result of such schemes is to drive up demand. That's good for people who want to sell their current property and upgrade, but it's not so helpful for those struggling to enter the property market in the first place. It's not going to address housing affordability, but it may have some role in stabilising house prices. Albert Edwards from Societe Generale dubbed the UK equivalent a moronic policy, and we agree. And the apartment glut is not over yet, according to the New Daily. Pete Wargent, co-founder of property investment advisory firm Allen Wargent, told the New Daily that the current oversupply of apartments in parts of Australia's major cities had made it much harder for landlords to find tenants and consequently had led to a drop in rents. He said that while Brisbane was, quote, coming out the other side of its glut, a steady stream of new apartments flowed into Sydney and Melbourne, and that was putting downward pressure on rents across the board and prices of new units. It will have less of an impact on the sale price of established apartments because there aren't many listed on the market at the moment. So there's quite a lot of competition there. But for newer apartments and the rental market, the oversupply is probably going to take another 12 months or so to wash through. It has already led to a drop in rents in North Sydney and units near the Pacific Highway, and that this has had a knock-on impact on established rentals too, because people start thinking, well, if I can rent a brand new apartment for however much per week, why would I rent an established one that has a bit of wear and tear? However, Mr. Wargent said that the shrinking pipeline of future projects and Australia's rapid population growth suggested any negative effects resulting from the oversupply of apartments would be short-lived. Well, we will see. And the death of a thousand cuts against the Hayne Royal Commission continues with, according to the Brisbane Times, AFG Chief Executive David Bailey saying that brokers often dealt with simpler matters than financial planners who already face their own detailed best interest duty. So just to shift and lift regulation into the mortgage broking industry probably isn't the right solution, Mr. Bailey said. However, Choice Director of Campaigns and Communications, Erin Turner, said the duty for mortgage brokers did not need to be exactly the same as duty for financial planners, but it should copy the spirit of the obligations on planners. Ms. Turner said that the industry's proposed good customer outcome test did not put enough emphasis on the quality of the recommendation to customers. They don't want an okay loan. They want the best thing for them in their situation, Ms. Turner said. Choice wants a best interest duty that requires brokers to understand client needs, conduct a reasonable market assessment, and make a written recommendation to clients. But across the board, the finance industry is pushing back on lending standards, broker commission reform, and now best interest duty. We are in grave danger of losing sight of the main point from the commission. Customers should be the centre of the finance sector, not just cannon fodder. And of course, the Prime Minister, ex-Property Council, is firmly on the industry side. So who, other than consumer groups and DFA, are focusing on the interests of the people? According to Reuters, investors are shorting second-tier Australian banks, while the majors enjoy their biggest rally in 3 years, as the market weighs up the long-term impact of a public inquiry that exposed widespread misconduct in the financial sector last year. The capital shift shows investors believe higher regulatory costs will hurt smaller lenders more than the big four market leaders, whose business models, if not their reputations, emerge largely unscathed from the year-long inquiry. Short bets on regional lenders Bendigo and Adelaide Bank and the Bank of Queensland spiked over a fifth in the week since the inquiry delivered its final report on the 1st of February. Their shares had already fallen about 15% in the same period, while the inquiry found that smaller lenders generally had behaved better than their bigger rivals. They have suffered sharper falls in lending growth and profitability in the wake of the Royal Commission. It's harder for them to absorb the extra regulatory costs, and they have a lower credit rating than the majors, and that means they've got a higher cost of funding. Plus, Bendigo has a portfolio of reverse mortgages that leaves them with a larger exposure to property than banks with standard loan portfolios, which concerns us given the current weakness in housing. And of course, APRA's move this week to reject any thought to redress the balance between capital required by the large and smaller banks in the majors' favour just makes things worse. We discussed this in our post, APRA Goes Back to the Future on Bank Capital. Bank shares were still hit by the thought that they will have to hold some more capital against more risky loans, but overall, there will be no real impact and capital will be lower compared with other countries. APRA is on the bank side and is captured. So to the local markets, the ASX 100 ended on Friday up 0.16% to 5,419, up 9.53% over the year, in heady, some would say, overvalued territory. The ASX Financials was down 0.82% to 6,239, up 6% over the past year, and the Local Vault Index fell 2.44% to 1355. Among the majors, ANZ fell 0.95% to 2817, 6.76% higher than a year ago. CBA was down 0.97% to 7965, up 16.3% over the past year as they announced the sale of their wealth management business, Count Financial, though holding a $200 million indemnity risk. NAB was down 1.09% to 2667, up 2% over the past 12 months, and Westpac was down 1.07% to 2783, up 1.15%. The Bank of Queensland ended at 954, down 2% over the year. Bendigo and Adelaide Bank is 14.69% higher than a year ago. They're down 0.86% to 1148. And Suncorp was down 1.26% on Friday to end at 13.35, down 2.31% over the year. Macquarie ended at 122.16, while AMP fell 5.8% to 2.11 on the news that AMP Super was being warned by APRA and issued with directions and additional license conditions designed to deliver enhanced member outcomes by requiring AMP Super to make significant changes to its business practices. Areas identified for improvement include conflicts of interest management, governance and risk management practices, breach remediation processes, and addressing poor risk culture and strengthening accountability mechanisms. The directions also require AMP Super to renew and strengthen its board. The Aussie Gold Cross closed at 1,952, up 0.63%, another record, and up 13.39% over the year. And the Aussie Bitcoin Cross ended at 10,034, up 19.08% over the year. In contrast, the Bitcoin US Dollar Cross is sitting at 8,657, up 5.23% on Friday, and up 30.2% over the past year, Clearly, in the era of uncertainty we are currently in, commodities such as gold and Bitcoin are receiving a lot of attention. One particular trader, an investor with over 25 years' experience of trading across Forex and crypto markets, says that as Bitcoin completes its first ever full 16-year cycle, the leading crypto asset by market cap will have reached a value of $150,000 per Bitcoin, have a market capitalization of $3 trillion, and have experienced a major coordinated attack and suffer a grueling 6-year-long bear market before the next phase in the asset's life cycle begins and Bitcoin reaches its true potential. He expects heavy and coordinated regulation and or outlawing of Bitcoin, coinciding with the top of the next Bitcoin bull run in around 2021. My point is simply, once again, Bitcoin is a high-risk speculative investment and no one can really tell where it will end up. However, in a world of lower for longer, I fully understand why people are looking at gold and Bitcoin for protection or for profit. Just remember, though, these markets are as highly manipulated as all the rest. So to conclude, we continue to see cracks in the financial system, rate cuts and asset bubbles. Nothing is getting fixed, but that can, dented though it may be, is still being kicked along. Destination, uncertain. Before we go, a quick reminder of our live stream event and Q&A session on Tuesday the 18th of June at 8 p.m. Sydney time. You can ask questions live on the chat or beforehand via the DFA blog, details below. I look forward to seeing you on the show, and remember to bookmark the event. Here is the link. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.